humans are actually really, really smart. We have natural inborn genius. And we've managed to socialize that out of us and then culturalize that out of us by consumerization, by a whole series of forces. That's not the only one, there's many. And if we can find a way for people to sort of express themselves fully, be vulnerable with each other so they can learn to trust each other and collect up data. I'm a big believer in, you know, evidence-based decision-making, build experiments, share what they know, etc. We can probably up our game on decision-making together vastly. The problem is we're in complete lockup around these things. We're just in complete lockup, and the lockup is political. The lockup is a power play at that level. It's not that we're stupid. It's that the people who have power and who are running sort of that level of game are making it impossible for us to collaborate across the aisle, so to speak. And so what you see is local initiatives everywhere that are doing brilliant things.
This time on the Plutopia podcast, technology consultant Jerry Mikulski joins John and Scoop in the virtual studio. We discuss Jerry's latest project, Open Global Mind, Social Media, the Era of Post-Truth, and much more.
Welcome to the Plutopia News Network. This is John Lepkoski. I'm here with Scoop Sweeney and our special guest, Jerry Mikulski.
Yay!
Jerry, I mean, on his site, it says that Jerry is a muse, a guide, and a connector. He's also been known as a technology consultant in plainer terms. He was a former managing editor of Release 1.0, which was an influential tech industry newsletter that Esther Dyson had started back in the early days of the internet. And Jerry is very well known as a networker. And actually, I'm going to read a little quote that I found on the Edge where you said, "People want to connect. They also want to make a living. Pretty simple. If they can do both at the same time, even better. How do people form community or a communion? How do they get this feeling of connectedness to other people? What kind of technology does it take? Does it even work through technology? The answer is yes." I thought that was a great quote and probably relevant to our conversation today. I should also mention that Jerry was founder of REX, the Relationship Economy Expedition, president and founder of Sociate, which he's been doing for over 20 years. And today, I think one of the main things we'll be talking about is Jerry's new project, Open Global Mind. So, Jerry, hello.
Sweet. Thank you. I was just sort of reminiscing as you were talking through some of these things and realized that I was writing about online community in 93 for Esther's newsletter. And I remember I had just finished my previous issue, which was about wireless communication, everything from infrared on your desktop to low Earth orbit satellites in the days of Iridium. And she said, "Do you know what you want to write about next?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to write about online community." And she said, "Huh?" And I was like, "Well, I've been on like The Well and CompuServe and AOL. I've been on all these things since I had a 300-baud Hayes modem, and something was happening." And right about then is when Howard Rheingold was publishing his book on virtual community, and it was great. And so we are many miles down the road from there, and yet a lot of the same things that were in evidence back in the day are sort of now, you know, bigger in the room. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I've been involved with online community for many years, starting with bulletin board systems, but that was really my pathway to The Well. I found out that the whole earth people had something set up where you could like meet online and talk to people. And I thought that was a pretty great idea. I was already fascinated with the idea of communities and community development. And I think that, you know, this is a way that we were probably somewhat aligned, though. I also recall that you and I didn't actually meet until, I think it was the year 2000. I think it was on Rise, which was a social network that had been set up for business networking. Do you remember that? Do you remember Rise?
I remember Rise for sure, yeah. And I was just remembering The Well. My first handle online was Spiff at Well. I, in honor of Spaceman Spiff, Conqueror of the Cosmos from the Calvin and Hobbes cartoons, who I think is my spirit animal.
Have you been back to the well lately?
No, not for years.
You ought to go back for a visit. They're still pretty active.
Amazing.
Jamming along. Yeah, that's a community that's been around since 1985, I think it is.
Yeah. So just to go back to Open Global Mind to pick that up, one of the things that happened to me when I was a tech industry analyst writing for Esther was I realized I didn't like the word consumer, and that has fed my journey for the last 25 years. And then the other thing is that one of the 4,000 odd startups that came and pitched me had a mind mapping app called The Brain. And I saw it, like the inventor opened his laptop and started demoing the brain for me. And I watched him and I was like, oh, that's kind of how my brain works. So I wrote about them, invited them to our conference, started using the software 22 plus years ago, now almost 23 years ago. In December, it'll be 23. And one of the big lessons from using something that let me curate things over time was that we are amnesic, that we have no memory, and that having no memory makes us, in some sense, stupider because we're not able to express what we know very well. We're not able to share it and improve it over time and debate with it and set up experiments around it and make better decisions and all that. So all of that is inspiration for this Open Global Mind project, which is not trying to build the next Facebook or the next Brain or like the next platform, but rather attract a bunch of projects that have already been working on component parts of this, such that they might interoperate better, such that we might figure out how to do more of this with one another and figure out how to do all that.
And this is, isn't it kind of similar to work that you've done in the past, not with a specific technology, but just in bringing a lot of people together who have projects and who can come together and sort of discuss their projects with each other or pitch their projects to each other?
Yeah, very much. When I say that I'm a connector, you know, online in one of my profiles, I mean it in the Malcolm Gladwell sense from The Tipping Point, you know, mavens, salespeople, and connectors. I'm a little bit of a maven because of this brain thing, but I'm definitely a connector because I love convening and I love introducing people to each other. And I spend a bunch of time on Zoom these days still listening to people with really bright ideas and trying to figure out how to help their ideas find better expression, or when I don't understand their ideas, calling time out and saying, hey, I know there's a pony here, but all I'm seeing is tail feathers, et cetera. So there's a lot of that in Open Global Mind.
And in sort of introducing Open Global Mind at the website that you set up for it, you relate it to the coronavirus pandemic. How did those two connect?
Well, we've been, in 2016, the Oxford English Dictionary chose post-truth as the word of the year. And we've been in that era. And my one of my concerns is that post-truth is not just like a 10-year digression, that it's not a decade, but it's a century or two, that we're going to enter an era where facts, science, journalism, whatever, are completely waylaid and overwhelmed by narrative and fear and whatever people want. And right now, we're kind of in this fight over the narratives that run our lives, the narratives in our heads. And coronavirus, this pandemic, and the lockdown strategies in particular, have forced a whole bunch of the dysfunctions of our social systems up to the surface and have forced these debates up to the surface. At this very moment, whether or not you wear a mask in the United States is becoming a political statement. And the teary-eyed governor of North Dakota is on video saying, please don't make this a political issue. This is really about saving lives. And yet, this philosophical argument, which is almost the defining battle of our times, I think, because it's shaping the world. Before this call, I was reading an article about Bolsonaro in Brazil and his assault on the Amazon and what's happening as a result of it. And he, of all world leaders, is the most adamant that this is completely bogus, that we should, in fact, just go socialize and not worry about it. So COVID is creating not only this moment where these issues are bursting, sort of boiling up into the surface, but it's creating a series of moments where people are sharing knowledge and doing mutual aid at the local level to take care of people who are vulnerable at this moment. It's creating, I don't know about you, but my email traffic seemed to double when we went into lockdown. And it didn't double because spammers were getting a hold of, you know, my email address better. It doubled because more people were busy putting interesting things in the stream. And I'm a natural curator of these things because I like to save them into my brain and try to make shake it to make sense of the world. And I'm kind of overwhelmed. I have 20 open tabs right now of meaningful things I want to read and process. But at least when I read and process something, I have a way of sharing it back out because I harvest what were the insights that were in the piece into my brain, and then my brain is available for anybody to go look at publicly. They can go to jerrysbrain.com, they can click on Launch Jerry's Brain, and they can just browse around for free.
Jerry, you mentioned the decrease in, or not an increase in, spam in your email. I've noticed an interesting trend in the number of robocalls, spam calls that me as a senior citizen type has been just deluged with for months and months. And when the coronavirus panic hit, they went away. And
that's interesting.
I don't know if anyone has studied that, but I would imagine it's because a lot of those call centers that do that sort of thing shut down, our people stopped coming to work. And
interesting, because I thought there'd been a rise in scam attempts worldwide because there's so many nice opportunities now to lie to people for whatever it might be, you know, unemployment support, for insurance, for whatnot.
Yeah, there are plenty of scams because you could see them actually on TV advertising.
Yes.
You know, get your copper infused virus mask. It's like, what?
God bless late night TV.
Even daytime TV. The companies are going on retooling and making masks that they're selling for $2 a piece out of paper.
I had heard that the robocall efforts sort of depend on having people available to take a call back or to pick up a call. In call centers sort of globally, and that most of those call centers are shut down right now because of COVID. And that was one explanation I heard. I don't know whether it was valid or based on research or just speculation.
I would love to see statistics on spam during lockdown.
There's a lot of discussions now around the term sense making, the idea of trying to make sense of things and how we do that and how well we do that. I tend to think that people are not as good at truly making sense of things as they may think they are. You mentioned sense making in the context of your OGM project.
Yeah.
So how within that context would sense making work?
So I think sense making is one of my favorite words. I think that babies are born trying to make sense of the world. Like, what is this? Who am I? Where am I? How do I fit? What am I connected to? And then later on, who will love me? What should I do with my life energy, et cetera, et cetera. But that our efforts at collaborative sense making, collective sense making, of trying to figure out the world together, go up and go down. And there's plenty of stories each of us have of terrible decisions that groups have made and brilliant decisions that groups have made. And I said earlier that the word consumer had kind of lit up in my head 25 years ago and formed a big part of my journey. And one of my ahas, one of my insights along the way, was that we consumerized not just consumer goods, but all of our spheres of activity. Like the electoral campaign we're going through right now is a consumer mass marketing exercise where media is central. Our healthcare system treats us as consumers. Our educational system, we're consuming degrees and we're treated as consumers in the system, et cetera. And I say all of that because when you're being treated as a consumer, you're being dumbed down. You're Joe Sixpack or Susie Homemaker, and you're being treated as a gullet with a wallet and eyeballs. You're not being treated as a whole human being who could create the good or whatever. And I'm overgeneralizing here because some very smart and more trustworthy entities are doing differently. They're treating us as humans. But by and large, you know, the whole advertising world is a stalker economy that's just trying to get us to buy more stuff. And so my own belief, and this is just my amateur sociology maybe, is that humans are actually really, really smart. We have natural inbound, inboard genius. And we've managed to socialize that out of us and then culturalize that out of us by consumerization, by a whole series of forces. That's not the only one, there's many. And if we can find a way for people to sort of express themselves fully, be vulnerable with each other so they can learn to trust each other and collect up data. I'm a big believer in, you know, evidence-based decision-making, build experiments, share what they know, et cetera. We can probably up our game on decision-making together vastly. The problem is we're in complete lockup around these things. We're just in complete lockup, and the lockup is political. The lockup is a power play at that level. It's not that we're stupid. It's that the people who have power and who are running sort of that level of game are making it impossible for us to collaborate across the aisle, so to speak. And so what you see is local initiatives everywhere that are doing brilliant things, but small, isolated, separated, trying to reach out to each other, kind of like, you know, rhizomal networks. It's like we're one big fungus that's trying to connect through the soil. And part of what I hope Open Global Mind does is it creates some really fertile soil where these networks can bind together, figure out how they can work with one another, and figure out how they can collaborate to build a better platform and set of tools with which we can have these better conversations, and not just among themselves, but with people they consider to be the other, with a capital O, people they are afraid of, people who've been attacking them, people who whatever. Because if we don't manage to bridge that gap somehow through compassion, through listening, through understanding, through offering better alternatives, whatever it might be, we are well and royally screwed in the long run.
Simply screwed. It seems to me that part of the problem here is that in sort of evolving to sort of deal with mass communications and mass marketing and mass whatever, that we had to go to a level of abstraction where we sort of like abstracted our humanness out of it. And, you know, the relationships of like marketing people and people who are trying to do sales, large, you know, large sales efforts and that sort of thing. And definitely in politics too, they're relating to people as statistics and as stereotypes and not necessarily, you know, human to human. And that we've lost that sense of relating to each other as human beings, really. And that we have just built sort of like templates of perception, mm-hmm. where we sort of see people as according to a conception that we have in our heads, and not necessarily taking the time to find out who that person really is or who those persons really are.
Yes, on five different levels. And one of those levels is just the technology that we use to communicate and that businesses use to communicate has been media, right? So you wind up, you make a whole lot of product in your factory, you've got to let people know about it. So early on, there were circulars, then newspapers, then radio, then TV. And, you know, TV becomes like when TV shows up, all these things kind of click in together and we really get mass media. And then World War II ends and a whole bunch of GIs come off the war and go to, you know, go to try to find jobs, and a bunch of them end up on Madison Avenue. If you watch Mad Men, you'll get a feel for it. And they look at this one-way broadcast medium where you basically launch stuff, and they're like, oh, I know what this looks like. This looks like artillery or bombing. And so the language of advertising is the language of a military campaign. And everybody seems to have this idea that it's therefore impossible to have any kind of authentic one-to-one conversations because there's just too many of us. That scale, the three words that have killed more good ideas that I've seen are it won't scale. Because we think we can't do industrial scale, you know, large scale with human relationships. I mean, that's impossible.
I like your observation about the military terminology, because one of the things we're always hearing about the media is we're being bombarded by media. Yes. And these days it's not very many voices being heard, because the media is basically, you know, three or four big organizations that are pushing out all of that media.
Absolutely. And well, and now social media means all of us are pushing out media, and your average fifth grader can become a media star all of a sudden by doing something that goes viral. And you're the fifth grader standing in the same classroom going, oh, wait a minute, the thunderbolt of fame could land on me if only I do something wacky enough, and that warps everything too. So we're kind of way down the rabbit hole of old media meets new media meets everything else, and we happen to have a U.S. president who understands this. I call it modern power. I put out a couple of videos recently about Trump and how to manage Trump in this next electoral cycle and the one we're in. And I said, Trump, in the 2016 electoral cycle, Trump was the only politician running for president who understood modern power. He understood that there was no way that CNN or MSNBC or anybody else could close the camera. They could shut the eye because their money depended entirely on showing this crazy clown shit show that he was doing intentionally. And he was then using Twitter to reinforce it. And you can watch my videos for more details on it. But that's crazy. But he did it and won, just barely. He, you know, didn't win the popular vote, but squeaked through the electoral vote. And there was an orderly transfer of power. So here we are. And he is one of a dozen populist, increasingly autocratic, alt-right kind of people running countries right now. I mentioned Bolsonaro, there's Orban, there's a whole series of people doing this around the world. So this is a big deal right now. And to my mind, if we can find our way through it to make better decisions together, that's going to be a big win.
You mentioned his use of social media, and the slapdown finally came today when Twitter dared to tag him as inaccurate content.
Did you go to Twitter and look at that tweet?
Yeah, and it was just about voting, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes, but there's just like a label with a little exclamation point on it that says, for facts on voting. There's not like a red margin on the tweet or a yellow and black ribbon around it that says this is a lie. It just says, for facts on mail, you know, mail by vote, go click here. And if you were to click, which nobody on the right is going to do, not a soul, you then might see some articles about, hey, you know, what Trump is saying is counterfactual, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think Twitter went way nearly far enough in doing this. And I don't know that this smackdown works at all, because I remember the day when Mitt Romney tried to throw his body in front of the Trump train during the campaign. And then I remember watching CNN as Trump took an hour to show up while they had the Chiron saying Trump to answer, and then took an hour to pimp his hotel, destroy Romney, and proceed to win the election.
Interesting that you mentioned Romney, because another story today was that Romney was, I guess I shouldn't use the word attack, but that he was maybe confronting Trump about Trump's ongoing disinformation spreading about Joe Scarborough, that Joe Scarborough may have murdered an intern.
Right.
And Romney said, enough of this, you know, let's just cut this out.
That is not going to help anything. I mean,
Trump is going to stop?
How many times has Trump been told not to talk about birtherism and Obama? How many times? Right. And Trump arguably became president riding that horse.
I don't think it matters whether it stops Trump himself. I think it matters whether it resonates with people who might otherwise have continued to support Trump.
But yes, but
people are pretty locked in.
But part of what I say in my series of videos about Trump is that these people like Trump because he's paying off for them. If you go look at the jobs to be done framework that Clayton Christensen and others came up with, basically, a bunch of people voted for Trump because the system was rigged and broken for them, and they just wanted him to break the system. And for them, every time he does something that inflames the left and the media, they're like, score. Seriously.
It's interesting that you say that, because
they do high fives. They do high fives, and they're cheering because that's what they hired this dude to do, and he's pulling it off.
Yeah, I was talking to some people who are really devout Christians, and sort of asking them, you know, I said, well, you know, Trump is really kind of a bad character. Why do you support Trump? Why are you guys such avid Trump supporters, which they were? And they said, because he's protecting us. He's going to protect the Christian church. He's going to protect Christians. And they felt, you know, I guess somewhat persecuted that they were not getting that protection before he took office. And regardless of what he might do and regardless of what his character might be, they're convinced that he has their back.
Well, for hawks, racists, ultra-conservatives, and evangelicals, Trump has already paid off better than any conservative or liberal president in the last 100 years. No doubt about it. No, there is no doubt in my mind.
Many of the
people have already done more. And with McConnell's help, they've been packing the judiciary in a way that's going to pay off for 30 years.
Many of the people that support Trump are not necessarily loving it, but they're doing like the old thing parents used to tell their kids when they gave them really nasty tasting medicine, you know, is hold your nose and swallow and try to deal with it. And that there's a lot of that, I think, going on of people are holding their nose and saying, it's good for part of what I believe.
Yeah, let me reframe that for you. Trump is God's flawed messenger. It's not that you have to hold, you are holding your nose to click and vote for him probably because he does the stateful weird things, but he is God's flawed messenger. That is the word through some highly religious communities that are busy overlooking his insane transgressions and stupid selfishness and egotism and like brutality and all that, because he's got lots of marks in the win column for them, and God's messengers aren't clean. They're not perfect people. Look, it's crazy, but you know, acts of faith allow people to do that. That's faith. I'm fascinated by religion and faith practices because an act of faith is in fact the renunciation of logic to leap over into a worldview that is different. Immaculate Conception. Right. We don't think that's possible. Scientists would be like, seems like a story. But it's part of the dogma of the faith of Christianity. And it's an act of faith whose gesture, the act of being faithful, means you're willing to jump over logic and science to say, no, this thing over here is true. And then everybody on the science side is like, I can't believe these people. Can you? I'm kind of on the left, although I have lots of critiques of the left. We're agog, we're aghast, we're like boggled and frothy. And when you're frothy, you're disabled. When you're in a froth, when you're all worked up, when you're outraged and you're shooting everybody, including your own, you are working against your own interests. And the left doesn't realize that.
Yeah, I think they're having there's a real struggle on the left. The left, it's so disorganized anyway, and there is there's kind of like an internal polarization of the left. There's the left, and then there's the center left, and probably gradations in between.
And there's the left out also, the people mm-hmm. that have fallen from favor but still don't drink the Trump Kool-Aid.
And in general, there's this idea, kind of vigilante culture, where anybody who does anything wrong, it's off with their head. Not only have them fired and removed from the world, but salt the earth they used to stand on so that nothing will ever grow there. And what healthy cultures do with bad behavior, and go to the Dagara tribe in West Africa, and like somebody, some young man does something bad, and you circle up the elders and their parents and the religious figures, and, you know, the shamans in the tribe, and you sit and listen to why it happened. You basically try to mainstream them back into the tribe. Right? We're not doing that. We have this punitive vigilante culture that makes everybody afraid to stand up and speak up because you might get your head lopped off. And it's going to be vicious. It's going to be really vicious. And by the way, the far right has figured out how to weaponize social media, how to undermine trust, and how to work that little sucker, that echo chamber, like champs. It really works. And just to add a layer of sort of darkness here, the person on 8chan who came up with today's Pepe the Frog GIF that goes viral is getting high fives from all his buddies on that side of the curtain, and they're achieving a sense of community that they did not have before.
And a sense of power.
And a sense of power, and they are an insurrection, and they're allowed to just say the hell anything. Like, on the right, you can say anything and you remain president and lots of other offices now. On the left, you say you ain't black enough and you are pilloried.
So this takes me back to OGM.
Yes.
I have a hunch that you have some thoughts about how OGM can fix what's broken?
Well, I don't have magic, like I don't have the silver bullet that solves this or conquers it. I have a bunch of ideas about how to convene people to chew on different parts of this and to bring people who've done really miraculous things into the conversation. So Daryl Davis is a black jazz pianist and lovely human who over the last 30, 35 years has patiently gone and talked to KKK members over and over and over. And he has a collection of some 200 or 300 robes in his garage that were given to him by Grand Dragons and other high officials of the KKK who renounced it and left and had become his friends. And he did so by showing up and by treating them with respect. Dia Khan is a documentary filmmaker who did the film White Right and went into the homes and shooting ranges and clubhouses of white supremacists. She's from Pakistan. There might have been a sound person there, I don't know, but you can tell in the interviews that at some point these white supremacists were looking at her, looking around, going, shit, this is a hard conversation, but she's really vulnerable here. She's in, kind of put herself in danger to talk to me and listen, and she's asking a bunch of challenging questions. Those things are as important as, should we use Facebook chats or Discus or something else? Right? That the technological decisions are interesting and messy and varied. Like there's so many of them to make because we've really screwed up how the technology kind of tries to help us but fails to help us. In particular, I refer to our lack of memory. Like we're easy to spin because we have no shared memory. I saw that only because for 20 plus years, I used this mind mapping thing that let me curate my memory. And so I can consult, John, your entry in my brain is ancient and is full of stuff that you've done and written. And I can go back and look you up in my brain and refresh my wet brain, the onboard one, and get a picture of what I remember about you very, very quickly. And then as you do new things, I just add them and they get connected not only to you, but to whatever the topic is that you're writing about, to other people's ideas about that topic. This process nobody gets to do because we're drowning in the info torrent because all of our tools are flow tools and none of them are for curating a stock. There's only the Wikipedia. That's the only other tool I know of that does this. And the Wikipedia is very different from this brain thing.
Well, it seems like curation is something that is really needed in a lot of areas because it's easy to do any kind of media. Anyone, as you said earlier, anyone anywhere can make themselves into a social media star or a TV Absolutely. Star because it's so easy to do. Unlike, you know, the old days when there was, you know, you couldn't afford the production equipment for TV or radio, but anyone can do it now. Look at us.
With the cost of all
we're
the
doing
gear,
it.
Fall into nothing. Yeah.
But curation, you know, it's easy to make the stuff, but it's not so easy to make it well and make it usable.
If you must become a star, if you're bent on becoming a star, that's actually really difficult. If you're willing to roll the dice and put your sort of number in the lotto to become a star, that's pretty easy. And some of those numbers come up gold. Like they win big and they get bazillion followers and they become Casey Neustadt or whatever. And yeah, it's hard to tell which one.
You know, I think it's not just curation, too. The need and also the exercise that we're talking about, but also analysis. I mean, I think it's one thing to do really effective curation, but some of the best, like in blogging, there's been a lot of curation. Curation's been a big piece of what bloggers have done. Actually, I've always thought that the original influence for bloggers who were sort of curating and pointing at things was the way the Whole Earth Catalog did their reviews, or Whole Earth Catalog, Whole Earth Magazine. And the most powerful works of curation I've seen have included some analysis. You know, it's like not only do you point to something, but you also explain why you think it's important.
So OGM, Open Global Mind, wants to be a container for a whole wide menu of analytic tools as well as curation tools. And for me, there's not that much difference often between curating and analyzing. And one of our problems is that many of our analytic tools are kind of one-off. They don't talk to any other tools. You have to import data into them where the data is kind of captive and not shared back or improved. They're like their own little islands. And what if we were all working on bodies of shared collective data where we understood that the data was trustworthy over time, or where it was untrustworthy? Because Nora Bateson has a really nice term called warm data. What she means is data that has context, because context is everything. I can give you, climate measurements that were done by scientists and climate measures done by amateurs, and they're both trustworthy just in different levels. And if you understand the context, you can add a little, windage factor to what you're doing. So I think that the analytic tools are incredibly important. So I completely agree with what you're saying, John. And I want to find a way to motivate the makers of the tools to move toward one another, to move toward shared, improved data, and to make this sucker work so much better, so that when the Financial Times guy who's doing the graphs of coronavirus incidents that went viral early on, so that we can go use his data, so that he can share out his database and other people can say, oh, you know what, when you use time, it really screws things up. What's better is like the first derivative of incidents, and really only need to, you should really only look at deaths, not cases, because everybody's measuring wrong and blah, 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 blah. Those are really interesting conversations to have. And I'd love to have them in ways that nourish and calm the fiery conversations that are happening at the political layer that we talked about a whole bunch just a little while ago. And I'm not sure that's feasible, because one of the tactics of winning the fiery conversation is to use huge bellows to stoke the fire. It's completely intentional. It's completely intentional. If you want some background on it, watch Adam Curtis's documentary for the BBC called Hypernormalization, spelled the British way with an S, not a Z. It's on YouTube. And he's saying we are already in a nonlinear war, and in a nonlinear war, information warfare is cheaper than bombs and bullets. And I actually believe that. I think that we are, like, Putin has a guy named Surkin, who is his lieutenant, who years ago was basically creating the fog of war, distractions in the political sphere. They would fund their opposition, and then they would tell everybody they were funding the opposition. So you're a citizen in Russia, you don't know whom to trust anymore, because Putin just funded these guys who look like good guys. So you'll buy anything. So if I can make you skeptical about everything, I've won.
I'm starting to think, I'm starting to see you as kind of like a contemporary Stuart Brand, and OGM is kind of like what the whole Earth catalog.
Stuart is one of my role models. I admire him a lot. I don't know that I agree with him politically, but I love what he's done. And Kevin Kelly also.
I would love to see interaction, between all these curation and analysis applications or things, but it's not going to happen in the big corporations, because all of us have been together on the internet and in computing for a long time, and they do not share well together. Microsoft does not want their stuff to run on any other platform.
No, that's changed a lot under current management. I mean, the Microsoft of today is real different from the Microsoft that I grew up in as an analyst. I mean, it really has changed a lot. But still, they're sort of protective. And I'm trying to find the furry little mammals that are trying to outrun the dinosaurs and get the mammals together to say, all right, dudes, like, if we can work together, one of the analogies I like is like leaf cutter ants. Do you guys know that leaf cutter ants don't eat leaves?
They cut them, right?
They cut the leaves, but they can't digest the leaf. They can't eat the leaf. So they cut the leaves. They take them down into the nest. They hand them off to basically the curator, the farmer ants that are right on the fungus. And there is this gigantic fungus that they're tending down underneath in their nest. And they mulch up the leaves, and with their spit on the fungus, basically the fungus metabolizes the plant matter and turns it into a beautiful nectar that all the ants eat. So by keeping the fungus healthy, all the ants stay alive. And it gets really interesting and detailed. Like, there's a white powder that's all over the ants that are closest to the fungus. That white powder turns out to be a natural antibacterial that keeps the fungus healthy. All kinds of interesting things happening here. And what I'm trying to say is, if a bunch of us curators can come together and manage this fungus together so that it's credible and useful to a whole bunch of other entities who'd like to feed off it in different ways, and if we can participate at these different levels, you know, the data level, the tools level, and the discourse level, I think we can start to make a dent in this. And I don't think it happens quickly. I make no claim to have a magic bullet that anything like in the middle of this is suddenly gonna dissolve everything. But if we don't do this, I think our future is really bleak.
The reason I thought of Whole Earth was because, their sort of motto or tagline was access to tools, or maybe access to tools and ideas. And it sounds to me like you're kind of building up this doesn't seem like you're building a tool. You're building a network, and you're building a network that facilitates access to tools. Am I right about that?
Yeah, and also that brings people together to think and rethink how they're doing things. There may even be, this thing, Open Gold Mine, is still in the early phases, but there may even be a playful religion in here. Like what? And I say that because right this minute, we're at a moment where the social contract is being renegotiated by force worldwide. The protest movements, the Arab Spring, Occupy, all kinds of other protests that have happened, these are all fights against the social contract, which isn't working all that well everywhere. In America, it seems broken to me. The European Union seems to be falling apart. China is trying to make itself the hero of COVID, but was kind of a bit of the cause of COVID, et cetera. But we're all trying to figure out, what is our agreement with one another and with our governments? And should we have a government small enough to drown it in the bathtub like Grover Norquist would like, or should we have a government that's more like Sweden, right? Which is not small enough to drown in a bathtub, but does like pretty good things. And of course I say Sweden because intentionally it's controversial in the middle of this COVID epidemic. So I think that there's a piece of this which is about access to tools, and to me, Whole Earth Catalog was extremely tools-oriented and was the first place that started to collect up a bunch of different tools that could help you do permaculture, social action, self-sufficiency, etc. Here I'm saying it ain't just about the tools. It's about the vulnerability and connections and discourse and reconnecting us in some way that's useful, credible, and will help people who are very different do something together.
Yeah. So what are your steps going forward from here? I mean, I was looking at your early design questions and you know, which are kind of like requirements and inquiries. What are you going to do now to try to make this happen?
So early stages right now, and I'm trying to sort of invite a few people in for the initial discussions to be architects, to kind of frame this up. And there's a bunch of very different issues that could use framing up. There are these kind of architectural low level, how do we create distributed shared data? Is it like the, you know, linked data object model? I don't know. That's beyond my pay grade. But I know a bunch of people who are really, really smart on that stuff. And then there's this discourse and deliberation layer where I don't think there's one model for how to do that. But boy, I know a bunch of rock stars who are really, really good at that. And then there's tools like The Brain or Kumu or Prezi or whatnot, most of which are proprietary and kind of inward facing into their little silos. Can I talk them into playing in this pond and opening up their tools toward the data and toward one another and making them useful in groups? Can I train up people who are really good at using all these tools to then participate in new virtual meetings? Since business life has moved to Zoom for a while, it's actually easier for somebody to be curating something digital during the meeting that is then useful as an artifact from meeting to meeting to meeting. What if, like, what we talked about, made decisions we made, were at hand, not just in the stupid SharePoint file system, which is horrible, but in some other artifact that was actually not just useful, but maybe a little bit beautiful. So that's kind of where I'm aiming. And I'm, at this point, I'm trying to attract people who would like to be part of designing this. Then I'll try to attract people who have built some of the working parts that are open source, because those are the first people you want to include. because already if it's open source, a whole bunch of architectural components may exist in the world. And then I want to approach other entities. But along the way, I'd like to build sort of a container that will host commercial projects. So there will be clients doing paid work using aspects of this platform who may not be bought into all of the program, but who may really like and appreciate the things that this program is heading toward.
It sounds like you want to build a social wiki that everyone can contribute to and access regardless of what their creation or their needs are.
I think if you remove the whatever anybody's personal biases about wikis are from that sentence and hold like the ideal thought of what a wiki could be, like working wikily, I'm completely on board.
Are you familiar with data.world?
Let me look.
I actually put a link in the chat.
Oh, cool. I haven't been looking at the chat. I don't know that I know them.
Yeah, I'd introduce you. Brett Hurt, who is the CEO of data.world, is going to be our guest on our live thing next Tuesday night.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, what they're doing is they're building a sort of framework for hosting data, hosting databases.
Fabulous. That's very
cool. Data catalog.
A data catalog, he calls it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's exactly his name?
Brett Hurt.
Brett, H-U-R-T?
H-U-R-T, yeah. I'll make an online intro.
So I have Brett in my brain under Core Metrics. Is that the right Brett?
Yeah, he was a Core Metrics guy. He did Core Metrics and he did Bizarre Voice.
Okay. So all I have him under is Core Metrics. I don't even have his LinkedIn profile connected to it, but I can build from there.
Yeah, good guy to talk to.
That's awesome. Thank you.
So, Jerry, we usually go for about 45 minutes. I think we're about at the end. Is there anything else you want to say to sort of wrap up the conversation that we've been having?
So it's funny because some of what we're talking about sounds like it's a little geeky or a little abstract or a little whatever, but in our conversation we rapidly went to places that are important. Like, could we make it so that people, so that we stop fighting each other over the joystick before crashing into the like canyon wall as a society? And I think to me that sounds important, right? And that's what it feels like we're doing right now. And so I'm interested in provoking that conversation, and I'm painfully aware of the dynamics in the arena and the fact that some people, you know, I coined the term denial of discourse attacks some years ago. Because, you know, everybody knows what a denial of service attack is on the web, when, it, you know, send your server too many pings so it can't serve anybody. Denial of discourse attack is basically flooding the arena and, you know, undermining the credibility of the person hosting the conversation or making the accusation or whatever. And before you know it, it's impossible to have that conversation. How can we create trustworthy conversations and experiments in that arena, in that world? And so I'm an idealist and an optimist at heart. I'm also a bit of a cynical realist, as you can probably tell from how I'm painting, you know, my picture of how I think the world works and where we are now. So I'm hopeful because I think this could be a really exciting thing to do together. If people are looking for a sense of purpose in what they do every day, got lots of purpose on the table here. So I'm excited to be doing this, and feels like it pulls together a lot of things that I've cared about for a really long time. And it's interesting to people like you, who I would like to lure into it, etc. So there we are.
I'm very lurable these days.
Well, if you get it going, I'll sign me up.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you for the invitation to this conversation. I really appreciate it. It's nice to think out loud and to think with you.
Well, yeah, let's follow up in a couple of months and see where we are.
Perfect.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Jerry.
Thank you, guys.
Learn more about Jerry and Open Global Mind at openglobalmind.com and jerrymikalski.com. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.